I was walking up 8th Avenue in Manhattan on an April day in 2007. My then husband and I were hurrying to pick up our luggage from our hotel and catch a train home when we passed a woman violently shoving an 11 or 12-year-old boy into a phone booth and yelling at him about his behavior. I assumed the boy was her son, and that if she was so violent in public, abuse at home was common as well. We said and did nothing, continuing on our way. We discussed the event later, on the train we caught, both haunted by our inaction. There was no excuse. We missed a chance to intervene. Even if we did not stop a cycle of violence, we missed the chance for the boy to hear that what he just experienced was wrong. We couldn't justify away our inaction by saying the woman could have turned her physical violence on us. She was petite, and my then husband was 6'5", 250 pounds, and had extensive training in self-defense. I'm quite certain he could have restrained her, even if she had a weapon. We were bystanders. I still feel sick more than 13 years later that we said and did nothing. We agreed that should there be a next time, we would have to be upstanders. I have skill sets now that I didn't have in 2013. In 2007, excuse me. Had I been an upstander in that moment, I imagine I might have yelled at the woman for being abusive, as if a public scolding could have made a difference. Yet thanks to Tara Brach, a meditation teacher and psychologist, I realized that acting as an upstander should build on compassion and shared humanity. Tara shared a relevant example. A woman intervened in a grocery store when a mother was getting increasingly frustrated with her young son as they navigated the aisles. The upstander commented on how intelligent and inquisitive the young boy seemed, and said her own children were often exhausting when they were his age. The mother paused and her face lit up. She raved about her son's brilliant and inquisitive nature, and she agreed that he could tire her out. A few minutes later, the upstander passed the mother and son again. This time, the mother was telling him they'd make his favorite dinner when they got home. This upstander broke up the escalating tension and gave the mother a chance to reconnect with her best self as a parent. Assuming that we can reach the best in someone when we act as an upstander means coming from a place of compassion. I also know that having the desire or disposition to be an upstander isn't always enough. It's important to practice when it's easy, so action becomes a habit we're better able to continue and implement when it's difficult. A famous 1973 psychology experiment with seminary students suggests that situational variables matter. Seminary students were sent to an event across campus. One group was told to hurry because they were already late. Another to hurry or else they might be late. And a third group was told they had plenty of time. On their journey across campus, all seminary students passed a man slumped in an alley, in visible and audible distress. More than 60% of those not in a hurry stopped to offer assistance. Only 10% who thought they were already late stopped. Now, clearly, these results weren't because all the compassionate people were in the third group. This study suggests that cultivating the dispositions to be an upstander isn't enough. Situations matter. I wonder if my ex-husband and I would have stopped that day in New York City if we weren't hurrying to catch a train. I view this as a call to practice so we can build confidence in our ability to act, hone our observation skills so we can catch more opportunities, and build strong upstander muscles in the process. My name is Sarah Fry. I'm a professor at Boise State and teach courses that focus on human rights.
This is Steve Fulton's song, Walls.
Set you free. Apostasy, hypocrisy, don't do much to set you free. Walls between us, walls between, fancy, it's blinded our ability. To try and see a way to see the bridge that goes from you to me.
Welcome to the Voices of Idaho. My name is Dan Prinzing, Executive Director of the Wasma Center for Human Rights, here today with Adam Thompson.
Hey there.
And welcome, Sarah Fry. This season, we're focusing on being an upstander. Sarah's just shared one of the stories that has prompted her own examination of who and what and when do we step up as an upstander. Sarah, how do you translate from that experience, from the knowledge you've gained, into action today? What do you do today to be an upstander?
So one of the things I've learned about compassion is to make sure that I take a couple of deep breaths before I respond when I have the opportunity to act. I can think of a time when a family member used the R word in a very disrespectful way of not just people who have intellectual disabilities, but also people who are low income. And I was so triggered that I think I didn't time myself, but I bet you I waited 5 to 10 minutes before I was able to approach her from a place of compassion and able to have a conversation where I wasn't triggered by that disrespect. And the conversation actually went really well. I try to look out for small opportunities to kind of practice and build those strong upstander muscles. There was a day I was hurrying, driving to somewhere downtown, and I was coming down from, we have a street in Boise, not too far from here at the Wasma Center, where the road makes a 90 degree angle and then another. And I passed a car going the other way that had stalled, and two people were pushing it on this very scary 90 degree angle. And I couldn't reach them. I couldn't go and help with the process because there's a dividing median. So I pulled over as soon as I safely could, and I called the non-emergency police number to let them know and ask if they could send a patrol car over. And they did, and they told me, if you have an experience like this again, go ahead and call 911 so we can offer help sooner. And I don't share that story like, oh, look, I did what probably anybody would do. But if you look at it as a chance to practice, if I can't take 3 minutes from a busy day to do something that doesn't involve confrontation, that doesn't involve any kind of risk at all, then how can I hope to have the courage to do so when it's hard and when it means confronting somebody?
I think you've just used an important term, and it's certainly one that we're analyzing and using more in center programming, is can we confront without being confrontational? And we're going to come from that place that many of the actions of the upstander can begin with a conversation, just as you did within your own family example, that how do we start those conversations? Maybe a little uncomfortable. Too often, we choose to just walk away. What was the importance of that moment for both you and for the receiver of the conversation?
Well, for me, I've had the real honor of getting to coach Special Olympics teams, and in so doing, I have seen how individuals with intellectual disabilities just thrive in a space where they have opportunities to be leaders and excel in doing some of the basic human things that have historically been denied to individuals from that population. So for me, to stand up in that particular topic was particularly important because I was honoring athletes that I know and care about. I hope for the family member that I planted seeds or maybe watered seeds that were already there to help them unravel what I believe is probably a lot of should I use the term programming, to think in disparaging ways of people who are low income. In terms of her specific use of the R word, I don't think it was intended as a mean-spirited dig on people with intellectual disabilities. It's just sort of that thoughtless use of that word that is so common, yet also becoming more and more, being reduced thanks to some really concerted efforts by various populations. The campaign to end the R word is one that comes to mind.
I think I'm picking up with it because certainly in our own experience in programming, the thoughtless use, not intentional, just the thoughtless use, just repeated without knowing the import of the word or that it is in fact targeting or demeaning others. How do you see not only in your scholarship, but in your practice on campus, how do we encourage a new generation of college students to be upstanders?
A really crucial thing for, I think, faculty and educators of all varieties to do is keep learning. I've been able to attend some really amazing workshops at Boise State. For example, I learned about the prevalence of microaggressions, these small digs that aren't blatantly racist, for example, but that can contribute to the overall diminished experience of students on the receiving end of those microaggressions. And so in learning about that and their prevalence, I knew better to be on the lookout for them in my own classroom. And amazingly, not that long after attending a microaggressions workshop, I heard one in a small group, and I was able to, I'd like to think I'd have intervened no matter what. However, because I had that language fresh in my mind and I'd been thinking about this issue, I was, I think, more gracefully able to speak and say something in a way that I hope unraveled. I guess the thing is, I just need to look at these comments as being part of a cycle that individuals are a part of and that they might not even realize are disrespectful, and that I have this opportunity to open hearts and start to unravel misinformation.
Well, that's certainly even we found in developing our human rights certification program that two of the core modules dealing with civility and respect. And I think in so many cases, we've lost both. Or we have been accustomed or emboldened to be incivil, the incivility that is occurring because we've forgotten how to have a conversation with one another. I like to think in terms of what you are suggesting, even on campus, that each of these become teachable moments. That for many, they don't know what they don't know. And so the onus becomes on all of us to call it out. Not to shame, but to call it out and say, hey, wait, do you realize what just occurred or what was just said? What is your hope at the end of each semester when you have finished with a group and you've introduced the courses, the human rights, the focus that you have in your classes? What is your hope at the end of this semester with your students?
My hope is that they'll be more comfortable having the conversations that are often scary to have. And so if that means being an upstander and confronting something that's said, or if it means feeling more comfortable approaching family members that they know think and speak differently from them to try to have a thoughtful conversation, that they feel more capable and confident trying to address inequities and tension.
Sarah, thank you so much. Our focus this year on being an upstander, we don't all have to do the same thing. We just each need to do something. Thank you so much.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of The Voices of Idaho, created by the Wasma Center for Human Rights. Big thank you to Sarah Fry for coming on the podcast and being featured in this episode. Also, big thank you to Steve Fulton for letting us use their song, Walls. Excellent. We'll have another episode up on the 1st of December, and we'll see you then.
Can we walk this road together? I can't. can't travel it alone. I need someone beside me to help me find my way back home. 'Cause this world is full of anger, and I've been walking through some pain. So if we walk this road together, we can find our way back home again. It's a home of many colors, no ceilings and no walls, but there is room for all our brothers with no graffiti in the halls. We can share this road together, so if you walk with me, my friend, with you right here beside me, we'll find a home with peace again. It's a home of many colors, no ceilings and no walls, but there is room for all our brothers with no graffiti in the halls. We can share this world together, so if you walk with me, my friend, with you right here beside